is the author of the international bestsellers The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, and Heaven's Mirror. His books have sold more than 5 million copies worldwide, and they've been translated into 27 languages. His public lectures and TV appearances, including the three-hour series Quest for the Lost Civilization, have put his ideas before audiences of tens of millions of people. He's become recognized as an unconventional thinker who raises legitimate questions about history and prehistory. And he offers an increasingly popular challenge to the entrenched views of Orthodox scholars.
Orthodox is a very important word, right? Don't offend Orthodox scholars.
They're wonderful.
I would have them over for dinner. I am sure many in this room strongly suspect that the history of the human experience is not quite what you were taught in school. For no small reason, is there a pervading sense that huge pieces have been withheld or dismissed by an increasingly risk-averse academia? Or political authority has placed whole sections of understanding on a need-to-know basis? Anyone who sets sail into the past to figure out what is missing and what has been distorted needs to be made of sturdy stuff. With an intellect as open as it is powerful, such a person joins us today. Please welcome to the stage for X-Conference 2009, Graham Hancock.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real pleasure for me to be here. I've just finished a new book, which is my first novel. And I finished 6 months of 18-hour days on Tuesday this week. And here I am. So if I'm a little incoherent this morning, please forgive me. But I'll do my best to stay as sharp as possible. I found it very refreshing to talk to you guys, those of you who've talked to me. I found myself amongst very open-minded, warm-hearted, good people. People who are concerned about the lies and misinformation that surround us like a bath all day and all night. So I see great hope in this gathering for a change in the way that things are done in the future. Now then, I have to get this. Oh dear, come on, bring somebody up here who understands the technology, and I'll carry on talking. I'm going to be talking today about. I'm not known for a strong interest in UFOs and aliens. I never actually saw the need to invoke alien technology in the construction of the pyramids of Egypt, for example. But as my work has continued, particularly in a new book called to the problem. It's intended as an addition to existing approaches to the problem, if you like, an additional weapon in our arsenal. Details. It's all in the book. Now, 1.65 million years ago down to 250,000 years ago. They're good tools, but it's as though our ancestor got stuck in a rigid frame of mind, absolutely nailed to the tracks, and were unable to expand their minds. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, like incredibly dull robots, these very boring tools. If you look, you'll find that it's really only about 100,000 years ago that our ancestors begin, just begin, to behave in a slightly interesting way. New things begin to happen. And what's interesting is that these new things are not linked to physical evolution. The fully anatomically modern human form has been in existence for at least 195,000 years. There's a skeleton from Ethiopia, 195,000 years old, identical to any of us in this room today. And we can tell from the brain pan that the brain was also identical. This is a fully anatomically modern human being. But that human being, 195,000 years ago, is behaving no different from human ancestors a million years ago. There's no change. Come down to 100,000 years ago, and things slowly begin to happen. The first thing is, around about 100,000 years ago, we start to get some evidence that our ancestors are interested in symbols. They're using jewelry. They're making shell beads. And from Blombos Cave in South Africa, the first piece of anything that you could call art, it's this little stone piece in the bottom right with the cross hatching on it. Some ancestor of ours sat there and made that pattern on that piece of stone, and that is the very first ever earliest surviving piece of true art that has come down to us from the ancient world. During this process, other things are happening to our ancestors too. They're using better tools. They're thinking more carefully about their tools. They're developing better hunting strategies. But it's only really after about 40,000 years ago that we suddenly discover that we are dealing with people like us who are thinking in fully symbolic terms and amazingly valuably are recording images on stone. And here in Chauvet Cave in France, 33,000 years ago, we find this astonishing explosion of amazing art. And if you look, actually, at this, you'll see that up at the rhino horns, up on the right there, you can see that they've built perspective into that art. We're often taught in art classes that perspective wasn't really introduced until the Renaissance. But there it is, 33,000 years ago, in Chauvet. And it's why Picasso said, when he was interviewed on leaving the cave of Lascaux, he was asked what he thought about those ancient artists. And he said, "We have invented nothing. They did it all. They did it all before us, long, long before us." So it was an extraordinary explosion of creative power. This explosion of creative power was accompanied by other symbolic acts, notably for the burial of the dead with grave goods. When you put in beside the corpse, you are asserting that you believe some aspect of that individual continues on after death. This is an extraordinarily sophisticated idea, and it appears at this stage. We're looking at the cave of Lascaux here, the Hall of Bulls. And these caves, and I've been privileged to visit quite a few of them, are the most extraordinary cathedrals. It is not simply the amazing art, but they have taken account of the whole environment of the cave. And as you go into it, a sense of the sacred sinks upon you, and you find yourself lost in this magical landscape, where the artists have made use of every feature of the cave wall to enhance the power of their art. And often, there are very strange features. Look at the antlers on this stag. That is not a depiction of reality. That is, a fantasy stag. That's a stag which you're not going to see out there on the hunt. look at the way these horses float, and also notice the strange geometrical patterns that you'll see in some of these designs above the horse on the right there, for example. Look at this cow. Perhaps that's the earliest example of the cow jumping over the moon. And look at the grid right in front of it. You have to ask yourselves, what state of mind were our ancestors in when they made these images, and what were they trying to depict? It's a sort of dream world. This is not, you don't see animals on top of each other like this, an auroch and a horse, in everyday life. And then the handprints. And what I found, and other researchers have found, when you enter these caves, and particularly when you look at the handprints, you get a sudden eerie impression. It feels like somebody's got their hand on the other side of the wall, and you're seeing it. It's like the cave wall is a membrane that separates you from another world, from another realm. And that's really the powerful impression that comes through from visiting these caves. You're probably wondering by now what this has got to do with ETs and aliens. I'll get to it. This is the cave of Pechmel in France. And look at the way they used the stalactites to frame the panel of the spotted horses. And let's go in to the panel of the spotted horses a little bit. And I'd like to just draw your attention again to the cleverness of the artist. If we go to the right-hand horse, you can see that actually the rock wall itself is a little bit like the head of a horse, and they've taken advantage of that. But if you look closer, you discover that the horse does have a painted head, and that this is tiny and totally out of proportion with the rest of the body. Weirdly, also, the dapples continue beyond the bodies of the horses onto the wall below them. There's a hand. So this is not just a depiction of reality. There's something else involved here. Very interesting. This is actually the earliest piece of cave art found anywhere in the world. I showed you that bit from South Africa 77,000 years ago. That's a geometrical pattern, but here we have a representation. It's from Fumani Cave in Italy. It's 35,000 years old. And if you notice at the top, the horns of a bull-like creature, the body and arms and legs of a human being. This is what is called technically a therianthrope. That's from the Greek therion, which means wild beast, and anthropos, which means man. They're man-beasts. They're a combination of man and animal. It is intriguing that the very earliest piece of fully representative depicts a therianthrope, a man-beast, part animal. We go to Chauvet Cave. Animals, we have another therianthrope, man-beast. This one's a bison man. You can see the head and horns of the bison. And you can see the humped back, and then it comes down to the legs of a human being. And this figure is straddling another figure. You can see the prominent pubic triangle there. It's straddling a female figure. But weirdly, I can't use my pointer here because I'm not in a position to point properly at the screen. So I'm just going to try to direct you. If you go above the head of the bison, you will see that the woman's figure is actually headless. But if you go over to her right arm, which is on the left side of the screen, you'll see that that arm has been transformed into the head of a lion, and that underneath it there are more lions at the bottom of the screen. So, again, we must ask ourselves, what state of mind led the artist to make this depiction? Bison man straddling lion woman. Lion woman is headless, but her right arm is depicted as transforming into the head of a lion. This is not something that he saw in everyday life. He's depicting a complex idea here, and we need to get to grips with what's going on. Hollenstein-Stadel Cave in Germany, again, the oldest art in the world. A lion man carved from mammoth ivory. He's about 3 feet high. And these figures from various caves, famously on the left, the sorcerer, who's a combination of stag, wolf, owl, and human being, and more bison men. On the right. These kind of images are scattered widely amongst the more familiar images of cave art, and they're there from the very beginning, as I hope I've demonstrated. Here are a couple of owls from Lascaux Cave. And here from South Africa, Again, the oldest piece of art found in South Africa is another therianthrope. Archaeologists have identified the hind legs as human, the fore parts as those of some sort of feline. And really an astonishing image here. And I actually do need to be able to point at the screen, so I'm just going to move around. This image shows human bodies with the heads of elands. And heads of elands. And you'll notice the figure on the right has this lumpy object wrapped around its body. Actually, there's two eland heads on that as well. And those are serpents with the heads of elands. They're composite animals wrapped around a composite human animal figure. And this is from the rock art of South Africa. Again, from South Africa, humans transforming into antelopes, figured on top of a zigzag line. Back to France. This isn't the first portrait in history. There are older portraits than 27,000 years ago, although they mainly show therianthropes, human-animal combinations. But I'm interested in the shape of the face, actually, the high domed forehead and the narrow pointed chin and just a hint of an eye. And when we come to these two images, the one on the left of the screen is from South Africa. The one on the right of the screen, you will see a sort of geometrical figure, and underneath it, just this faint image of a head, of a human head and a little body. And if we come in closer and redraw that human head with the little body, you can see that it does actually appear to be an image of what we would today call a gray. A narrow pointed chin, large dark eyes, and a high domed forehead. And that is in the cave of Pechmeul in France. I've studied it personally, and it is 24,000 years old. If we look at the full image, which you can see on the right of the screen, you can see that that figure is pierced. It's been stuck through with what look like spears or who knows what they are. And I just want to draw a little parallel with the alien abduction scenario and the probes and objects that people report being put into their body, although in this case, weirdly, it's the alien who's getting probed. And I wonder what that is above his head. I wonder what that object in the sky is above the figure's head. It's never been identified. But there are, in fact, images all over the caves, both in South Africa and in Europe, of objects that we today would interpret as flying machines. The object on the left from South Africa is clearly depicted as in the air. We know that because it's above a figure on the ground. There are two birds in the picture. And the creatures in this flying boat are therianthropes, part animal, part human. On the right, above and below, from the French caves, if any of us saw an object of this shape flying through the skies today, we would immediately say flying saucer. The archaeologists think that they're trying to draw houses or something like that, but they really have no idea what these things are. So the question I want to raise, there's no doubt that the symbolic revolution, which is featured in the cave art, which is manifested in the cave art, was the single most significant advance in the entire story of human evolution. 6 million years of boredom, and then suddenly everything bursts out into life, and that accompanies the creation of the cave art. And in the creation of the cave art, we see these odd figures that look a bit like the greys, and we also see the therianthropes, part animal and part human. And so the question I wanted to ask is, when they left us these documents, did they also leave us the images of the beings who helped them on to this next stage in their evolution? Were the cavemen the first humans to be contacted by the visitors in some way? And is it possible, actually, that these visitors were behind that huge leap forward in behavior that made us human? I don't think that we can rule it out. Now, in explanations of the visitor phenomenon, I think there's a little bit too much reliance on nuts and bolts explanations and too little reliance on the mysteries of human consciousness. And while the nuts and bolts explanations are extremely valuable, and many brilliant people have brought huge new information to light. I'm going to be going more for consciousness. And as I say, this is something I want to add to the arsenal rather than substitute. For about the last 20 years, this is one of the very few occasions when I find myself in agreement with mainstream academia. Mainstream academia has accepted for about the last 20 years what is called the neuropsychological theory of Cavant. And this explanation, I won't bore you with the details, it's all in my book with footnotes, but it is the most widely accepted explanation of what Cavant is. It wasn't hunting magic. That idea has been out for 40 or 50 years. The belief now, from an enormous amount of studies, the details are in the book, is that what we are looking at is the work of ancient shamans who were depicting what they saw in their visions on the walls of the caves. And actually, this is the single explanation that explains everything about cave art, that it's visionary art created by shamans. And we can understand more about it by looking at shamans still working and creating art today. Now, the one thing, the one universal feature of all shamanism is the altered state of consciousness. If you encounter an individual who calls himself a shaman, and if that individual remains throughout the ceremony in the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness that our society values, then I'm sorry, he is not a shaman. A shaman must use altered states of consciousness. It is the definition of shamanism. And those practitioners who use altered states of consciousness to explore the wider boundaries of reality are rightly called shamans. Many ways to get into altered states of consciousness. Here's an Eskimo, an Inuit shaman. And in his case, it's about isolation, it's about hunger and fasting, and gradually you put your brain chemistry into a visionary state where it becomes accessible. I think this business of altered states of consciousness can perhaps be better understood if I go back to that phrase I used a moment ago, the alert problem-solving state of consciousness, which is what our society values highly. Our society doesn't even believe, really, that there are any other states of consciousness are valid. When you call somebody a dreamer today, you're not really congratulating them, are you? But in ancient times, dreams were considered a valid means of knowledge. And I think that what the altered state of consciousness about is it's about a necessary separation from the alert problem-solving state of consciousness. If you're in that state of consciousness, you're going to be really good at alert problem solving, and you're not going to do much else. You're certainly not going to consider the visionary realm. So this is why shamans everywhere, and I just give a few examples here, use different techniques, here's rhythmic drumming, so on, different techniques to get into altered states of consciousness.
The use of mushrooms, very ancient in Central America, was discovered.
certainly use ancient most likely. Again, the details are in the book. But it was the mushroom, Psilocybe sibilantiata, psilocybin mushroom, that one, which was used by shamans in the caves to get into their altered states of consciousness. In Africa, it's iboga, the plant that enables men to see the dead. I have, of course, as a dedicated researcher, I was trying to put myself into investigation. So I have taken mushrooms, I have taken iboga. It was an awful experience of my life. 48 hours. It's the most extraordinary thing. In Central Africa, iboga is used, one of its functions is to contact your deceased ancestors. And I was, because often we don't have closure with somebody we love who's died, and you seek that closure. And I was seeking closure at the time concerning the loss of my my father. I found these visionary plants extraordinarily helpful in that area. The use of iboga is very widespread in Central Africa. Actually, the president of Gabon is a member of the working with the shaman Francisco Montes Shuna, Peruvian Amazon. I'm picking the leaves from a bush that's called chacruna in the Amazon. Its botanical name is Cicotria viridis, and the leaves contain pharmacologically pure dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which is an illegal Schedule I drug in this country and in most parts of the world. If you make a tea with dimethyltryptamine, with these leaves, you could brew up 100 gallons and drink them all, not going to have any effect on you at all. Absolutely nothing. Reason for that is that there's an enzyme in our stomachs, monoamine oxidase, which destroys DMT on contact. So you don't get it. You don't get any effect just from the leaves. You have to mix it with something else, and that's this vine, which coils itself up into a double helix, and this is called the ayahuasca vine. It means the vine of souls. And when it is taken and mixed with the leaves of the Cicotria viridis plant, what happens is the shaman will take lengths of the vine, smash them up, lay them down in a cooking pot, put about 300 leaves on top of that, more lengths of the vine, then cook it all up for hours and hours and hours. What's happening at the level of biochemistry is that there's a chemical in the vine which is a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. It switches off the monoamine oxidase in the stomach and allows the DMT in the leaves to enter your system. You have to ask yourself how they did this. There's 155,000 different species of plants and trees in the Amazon. And it's quite a mystery and a miracle that they were able to take these two and put them together, because remember, you don't get the properties unless they work together, to discover the visionary plant that they call the vine of souls or the vine of the dead. And the end result, you can see it in that plastic bottle there, is this thick, almost black liquid, which is the ayahuasca brew. Now, I should emphasize, since we are talking about a Schedule I drug here, dimethyltryptamine, a couple of points. First of all, the consumption of ayahuasca is legal throughout South America. And not only is it legal, but its use is protected under laws of religious freedom as an ancient and sacred heritage of the Peruvian Amazon and the Brazilian Amazon and all the other countries surrounding the Amazon basin. Secondly, dimethyltryptamine and DMT in ayahuasca are not addictive in any way. As a matter of fact, there are two major clinics in the world now, one of them in Peru called Takiwasi, who are using ayahuasca with phenomenal success to get people off addictions to hard drugs like heroin and cocaine. 50% of the drug addicts who go to Takiwasi after 1 month leave completely free of addiction and never return. Furthermore, they have not gone through through withdrawal symptoms. They are presented with facts about themselves and their own circumstances by this mysterious brew, which makes them rethink their lives, and they come out free of addiction. It's an astonishing thing. Many in the Amazon, and I have become one of them, I've drunk ayahuasca 30 times, we find that we are dealing with a spirit. We are dealing with an entity. There is a personality behind the ayahuasca brew. And that personality often presents herself as a serpent, sometimes as a woman in various forms. She's always female. She's the spirit of ayahuasca. She's recognized throughout the Amazon jungle. She's believed to care for and love the planet and to have time for human beings as well. And I've had some direct encounters with this being, which have had an extraordinary impact on my life. Well, when you drink ayahuasca, first of all, it's an ordeal. That's another reason why nobody's ever going to get addicted to this. I mean, you really have to brace yourself. You have to say, I am going to go through some hours of extreme discomfort and pain. I am going to be vomiting. I am going to have diarrhea. And I'm going to just have to jump behind the nearest tree to deal with that, because there's no toilets out there in the jungle. Okay. And we Westerners, we're kind of poor at dealing with bodily functions in a public setting. And, you know, I'm British, so it's even worse for me. So one of the things ayahuasca told me was, actually, the least important part of you, Mr. Hancock, is your body. That's the least important part, your physical body. What really matters is your spirit, your soul, who you are, your consciousness. That's what matters. And what ayahuasca is working with you at the level of consciousness is quite extraordinary. We have the work of Professor Benny Shannon of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem to thank for the knowledge of the astonishing universals in human experiences of ayahuasca. From all over the world, even if they have no background in the subject at all, people in a visionary state in ayahuasca see the same things. They've never compared notes. They have nothing in common with each other. But they go into the same enchanted jungle. And as they travel through it, they find crystal cities and strange beings meeting them. And these beings communicate with us telepathically. I know how nuts this sounds. I know that the tendency is to think it's just hallucinations. But I want to explain to you why I don't think it's just hallucinations at all. So here is the work of an ayahuasca shaman, Pablo Amaringo. After his ayahuasca journeys, he paints his visions. And this is one of those paintings. Here's another one. Serpents. Everybody who drinks ayahuasca sees serpents. What's the explanation for this? Is there a brain module for seeing serpents? Some might say, oh, well, we have an ancient instinctive fear of serpents, and that's why we see them. But the serpents you see in ayahuasca visions are by and large extremely friendly and welcoming, and say, come to the party, you know. They're very nice. And we all see these amazing vision serpents, which sometimes, again, will transform, as I said, into human figures. And, of course, therianthropes. If you look at bottom left, you'll see the creatures with the bodies of tigers. Look at their heads, and you can see that these are human heads. And again, serpents wrapped around human bodies in extraordinary saturated colors. And look at this incredible image from Pablo, where the jungle realm is united with the universe, and we see planets. And what do we see about midway down on the right-hand side, which I can't point at, which is here, which is there? What we see is a UFO, a flying saucer, actually. I think everybody's heard of the UFO sightings over Brazil, but flying saucers appear enormously in ayahuasca art. There's another one up there on the top left of the screen. And lo and behold, a therianthrope, a human body with the head of an alligator, in this case, on the right, just like the therianthropes that we see in the painted caves 35,000 years ago. Here's another of Pablo's work, therianthrope on the left, part serpent, part human, and on the right, a huge flying saucer. This is what Pablo sees in his visions. I've seen such things too. And just a comparison, the cave art on the left and Pablo's flying saucers on the right. Tens of thousands of years separate the two artists, but what they have in common is altered states of consciousness. I now want to draw some comparisons between the beings that we call aliens and greys, the beings that shamans call spirits, and to argue that they have a great deal in common. From the side of shamanism, we have the gigantic works of Mircea Eliade and hundreds of academics who've recorded the experiences of shamans all around the world. And from the side of the ETs, we have the late Dr. John Mack and his enormous body of interviews with ET abductees, David Jacobs, Bud Hopkins. We have a vast resource of information on experiences that individuals have had, which they have construed as being abducted by aliens. And so what I want to do is to make some quick comparisons between those and the experiences that shamans have with beings that they construe as spirits. And again, there's much more information in the book, but it's very well known that the spirits shamans encounter most frequently first appear in the form of animals, birds, or fish, or as part human, part animal hybrids. Oddly enough, the same turns out to be true for alien abductees. And I've given some examples. There's Virginia Horton, remembered talking with an intelligent gray deer, and she thought there's a person inside this deer. Another abductee saw a deer looking at her through the window just before she was abducted. Another saw a wolf standing on her bed, looking in her eyes. And John Mack sums up, the aliens appear to be consummate shapeshifters, often appearing initially to abductees as animals, owls, eagles, raccoons, and deer, are among the creatures the abductees have seen initially. So we have the spirit animal of the shaman, very often an owl, and we have an owl with humanoid characteristics in the Lascaux Cave, and very often the trace memory that people get from an alien abduction is of an owl. So there's a commonality there that I find most curious. Shamans report being floated up into the sky or climbing on a rope of light, or being drawn up on a thread of light. And there's some examples of that from South African rock art. Again, amongst UFO abductees, I feel like I'm in an elevator. There's no walls, it's just fast up. Then compare that with the Basuto shaman, the roof of the hut was open and he felt himself carried into the sky. Shaman in Botswana, I dance and I'm climbing. I climb the threads, I take them and climb them. Another one takes a rope and it floats him into the sky. And then you have UFO abductees reporting the same thing, that a line or a thread of light extended down to them. Arthur saw a light like a thread, a spider's thread, and so on and so forth. There's just an astonishing number of examples of this. Shamans, they are sometimes abducted, as well as going into the sky, they're sometimes taken underwater or into caves. Same story for ET abductees. Betty Aho, abducted for the first time, this UFO went into the sea and came out again. Then entered a huge crystalline cavern. Filiberto Cardenas, abducted by humanoids, taken inside a huge rock, taken into a tunnel beneath the sea. Carlos Diaz sees a UFO. It was made of millions of small dots of light. He tries to touch it, and suddenly he's inside a cave that was lined with stalactites and stalagmites. So astonishing similarities between the experiences of UFO abductees and shamans in that case. The shamanic ordeal. Shamans are always being pierced by spirits. They're constantly sticking things in them, and they often put implants inside the body of the shaman. Initiatory trances, piercings and tortures, including surgery, bone counting, the insertion of objects into their bodies, bizarre surgical procedures at the hands of spirits who insert stones, rock crystals, and other objects into their bodies. Are you with me? I mean, we have a similar phenomenon with alien abduction. We were talking about it yesterday, these implants. Very odd that shamans should feel the same thing. And you know, here are the examples from the alien abduction side. Again, crystals do appear into it. And this whole sense of being operated on that shamans report is also widely reported by UFO abductees. Shamans, they're constantly having sex with spirits. I know a shaman who actually his wife divorced him because of his relationship with a spirit woman. Yeah. Not only has he got a relationship with a spirit woman, he's got 5 kids with her in the spirit world. Well, there's some familiarities here with the alien abduction scenario too, because we're being us to reproduce with these aliens. And very often we're abducted again and again to go back and care for our offspring that they have for us. Very, very similar to the shamanic experience. And the sense of mission that many UFO abductees return with is absolutely reflected in the experiences of shamans. Maria Sabina was given a book, and she learned many things from the book. In 1961, Betty Hill was given a book by the aliens. Both she and Maria Sabina were not allowed to take the book back to Earth. Betty Andreasen was given a small blue book with 40 luminous pages. And after these experiences, they come back with healing powers and a sense of mission. Now, fairies and elves. I want to pay tribute here to the work of Jacques Vallée. Why do fairies and elves have so much in common with aliens and spirits? Jacques Vallée's 1969 book, Passport to Magonia, is an amazing intellectual achievement. And it draws in-depth comparisons between reports of fairy encounters in the past and alien encounters today. What I've done in Supernatural is I've taken Jacques Vallée's body of work as given, and I've then taken on from 1969 with the subsequent alien abduction reports and compared those with fairy lore as well. And so it's intriguing to see what happens here. Fairies, just like spirits and aliens, were renowned for abducting people. In fact, I've come to the conclusion, and this is just my opinion, that the thing called the fairy dance, that circular dance that fairies do, which brings them into existence and into our sight, and which they use also to disappear from our sight, is a very, very interesting phenomenon. Were you to approach the fairy dance too closely and touch it, you get pulled into it. You get drawn into it, and you can't get out again unless you happen to have a friend who just drags you out at the last minute. Once you get drawn into it, you're taken into fairyland. And when you're in fairyland, you start having missing time problem. It used to be much worse than it is today. People would get abducted by fairies. They'd come back 300 years later. They would just be a memory. Yeah, somebody in this village was taken a long time ago. Now they're not so harsh on us. We have much shorter periods of missing time, but it's a very similar phenomenon. I wonder if the fairy dance was the previous technology to the UFO. I wonder if it was a way of moving between worlds, of moving between dimensions, and if that's what the UFO is now. Fairies could be cruel. They tortured human beings. They hurt them. They were also kind. They gave them gift. They gave them healing powers, similar to shamanism and similar to UFO abilities. Power of flight. Fairies use aerial vehicles. Fairies do abduct people underground or into a cave as well, exactly as we found with UFO abductees. Many examples of this, which I hope you can read on the screen. Fairies and elves often appear as part animal, part human hybrids, as therianthropes. Here's a woodcut I have from the 15th century in Holland. Shows a group of fairies dancing in a ring. If you look closely, you can see that they are beast men. They have the heads and hooves of animals and the bodies of human beings. So again, this therianthropy is coming into the picture. Here's Melusine, a feared medieval fairy, part serpent and part human. What was she feared for? Abducting human babies. They would sometimes put in place a changeling who vaguely resembled the child but otherwise was not the child who had been taken. And again, I think this issue of the fairy abduction of babies and human hybrid human-alien children, there's again a tremendous connection here which we need to look at much more carefully. So these are some of the common forms in which aliens and spirits and fairies all appear. And since interpretation is built into all perception from the get-go, we humans, we can't look at something without interpreting it. There's no such thing as objective. You know, we see things through our frame. And what I'm suggesting is that spirits, fairies, aliens, it's all the same phenomenon seen through different cultural spectacles at different periods of time. Here are four drawings. Three of them
are from the roofs of the caves, dating back more than 20,000 years. One of them was drawn by one of John Mack's patients in 1990. And she said that that particular image was projected into her visual field just before she was abducted. All four images have great similarities. The modern one is lower right. So I'm suggesting that such experiences, the experiences of contact with visitors, can become accessible to us as much through alterations in our state of consciousness as through any physical investigations in the material realm. And I'm going to talk a little more about drugs now, hallucinogenic drugs, LSD, dimethyltryptamine, mescaline, psilocybin, etc. Until our governments foolishly declared the war on drugs, thus enfranchising criminal gangs all over the world and handing over our young people to the worst people on the planet. Before this was done, a great deal of work was done with hallucinogens to explore human consciousness in the 50s and 60s. Other techniques, electromagnetic fields, sensory deprivation, hypnosis, rhythmic drumming, they also work too. But if you want to absolutely reliably put somebody into a deeply altered state of consciousness, you can't do much better than DMT. And you can do it on target. You know, you can say, okay, we're going to run this experiment now. In you go, out you come. Whereas with rhythmic drumming and others, it's much harder. So there's great advantage of these visionary plants. Now, typically in the altered state of consciousness, you go through a series of experiences, strange patterns and figures start to appear, and then it's as though you've gone through into a seamlessly convincing parallel world. And in that parallel world, you encounter beings. And here, as one of the volunteers from the 1960s drew in stage three on the right, what does he encounter but a therianthrope? Dressed up in a modern suit, of course, but with the head of a fox. Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico has done astonishing work. I'm sure many in this room are familiar with it. If you're not, get this book and read it, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. It is fundamental importance. He's a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico. He was the first American scientist for more than 20 years to get permission from the federal government to conduct experiments with human volunteers using dimethyltryptamine. And so over a period of some years, with many volunteers, Rick was giving them DMT in injectable form and recording their experiences. Their experiences are astonishingly like the experiences of UFO abductees, but we know they weren't abducted. They were on a hospital bed right there in the University of New Mexico, but something was happening to their consciousness. Maybe their consciousness was abducted. I'm serious about that. Jim, a DMT volunteer, there were clinical researchers probing into my mind. There were sort of long fiber optic things that they were putting into my pupils. Carl, that was real strange. This is straight after a DMT experience. There were a lot of elves. They were prankish, ornery, maybe four of them. Ben, I felt like something was inserted into my left forearm. It was long. There were no reassurances with the probe, simply business. Remember, these aren't conventional UFO abductees. These are people who've been given DMT on a hospital bed in the University of New Mexico. Lucas, there's nothing that can prepare you for this. The sound, louder and faster. I was coming on, pow, there was a space station below me, and to my right, there were at least two presences, one on either side of me, guiding me to a platform, aware of many entities inside the space station, automatons, android-like creatures. And he feels overwhelming confusion and opens his eyes in this technological setting. The horrible drawing down there on the right, because I can't draw, that's me. I drew that. I drew that after an ayahuasca journey in the Amazon. And I had my only first ever kind of abduction experience, because I saw a UFO, saw a big flying saucer, several actually, and then beside it this figure with these insect eyes, but a figure like a gray, and it looked very grim and very, very dark and serious, and I suddenly said, no! And I opened my eyes, and I utterly refused the vision, because I felt I was going to just be taken out of there. Later on, I regretted refusing that vision. You can do that with Aya. You can say, no, I don't want it. And I did. I regret it. I should have had the courage to go through with it and see where it took me. That guy hasn't visited me again since then. on Aya Journeys, but I hope to continue. Some other examples in type there from Rick Strassman's DMT work. When I was first going under, one of his volunteers says, there were these insect creatures all around me trying to break through. Another one, there were four or five of them. They probed, they really probed. They weren't benevolent, they weren't non-benevolent. One goes into an alien laboratory. There's beings there. They had a space ready for me. And so on and so forth. Very familiar from the alien abduction experience, a sense of being taken into deep space, of being put into another realm. And one of them says, I always knew we weren't alone in the universe. I thought that the only way to encounter them is with bright lights and flying saucers in outer space. It never occurred to me to actually encounter them in my own inner space. And I think this is a terribly important point. Strassman admits to being baffled and nonplussed by his DMT research. And in fact, he eventually stopped it. He stopped the research because it really was blowing his mind so much that all his volunteers were reporting encounters with the same beings and they weren't comparing notes. And this is supposed to be non-real. Yet normally we define something as real if all of us agree that it's present. And so he, in the green there, I think you can read the things that surprised him and that how they challenged his prevailing worldview. Now, we could say perhaps Strassman's volunteers were reporting these alien abduction type experiences because they'd picked it up from the culture. You know, they'd watched X-Files or read National Enquirer or whatever it is that you read, and you get the image of the gray in your mind. But actually, this can be definitively disproved because research was done with DMT in the 1950s before a single alien abduction experience had ever been publicly reported, where we find exactly the same phenomena. Stephen Sarah's research in the 1950s, again, I won't read it out, but the type of encounters that his subjects were having, I saw strange creatures, dwarfs or something, taken up into the sky, very similar to the alien abduction experience, but nobody was reporting alien abduction experiences in the 50s. So it's not something they're getting from the culture. I think it's more likely that the culture is getting this imagery from visionary experiences. And yes, Strassman's volunteers were not being physically abducted. However, Rick Strassman, and I'm 100% with him on this, is not of the view that that means these experiences are not real. These experiences are real. They're absolutely real. What's happening is that he's suggesting that by conceiving of the brain as a receiver of information, we can accommodate the model of changing brain function with a chemical. And it allows that what is received, while not usually perceptible, is consistently and verifiably existent for a large number of individuals and may indeed reflect stable, freestanding, parallel planes of reality. And what is reality? Here's Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD, making a very correct point that it's inconceivable without an experiencing subject. It's the exterior world and the receiver, the ego, in whose deepest self the experience is registered. This idea that our minds shut out more than they let in was represented by William Blake with the notion of the doors of perception, that if we could just clean the windows through which we see reality, we'd see much more than we normally do. William James, the brother of the novelist Henry James, a great psychologist of the early 19th century, experimented with nitrous oxide, and he felt that no account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness quite disregarded. At any rate, they forbid a premature closing of our accounts with reality. And of course, Aldous Huxley argued at length that really what the brain does is it functions as a reducing valve. We would be so overwhelmed if all of reality poured in that our brain shuts 99% of it out. And it's the other 1% that we focus on with our alert, problem-solving state of consciousness. And Aldous Huxley saw the hallucinogens as what he called gratuitous graces, which allow us temporarily, they give us a temporary bypass of the reducing valve and allow us to see reality as it really is. And Hoffman makes the same point. The true importance of LSD and related hallucinogens lies in their capacity to shift the wavelength setting of the receiving self and thereby to evoke alterations in reality consciousness. Think about that. We are talking about the brain being the instrument with which we perceive reality, and that the wavelength setting of that instrument can be changed. So normally, we are tuned in to channel normal. That's our everyday life. And it's just as well that we're tuned into channel normal. Otherwise, we'd all be walking under buses and jumping out of windows. We understand the laws of physics. But the question is, should we be only and exclusively tuned into channel normal, or should we consider other realms of reality? And the suggestion is that this is what DMT and other hallucinogens allow us to do. And to cut a long story short, what Strassman is suggesting is that we all, I should have mentioned this before, but everybody in this room is illegal, okay? Go to prison right now. You know why you're illegal? Because you've all got DMT in your bodies. Every one of us. It's produced in the pineal gland in the brain. And if your urine or blood or cerebrospinal fluid is assayed right now, you will find DMT in it. We tend to have it normally in sub-psychedelic quantities. Strassman's suggestion, and he worked with John Mack on this, is that UFO abductees may be people who overproduce DMT, spontaneously overproduce it, and it puts them into the DMT state. And there, crucially, they are not having illusions and hallucinations of non-existent things. They are being enabled to see what they normally cannot see, which is there, which does surround us all the time, which is part of our reality, but which our alert, problem-solving state of consciousness that we so highly value shuts it out. And so these temporary bypasses allow it to come in, and lo and behold, when it comes in, we start having these extraordinary experiences. And this is the point that I will finish on, really, that nothing in science allows us to reduce hallucinations, so-called hallucinations, to the brain chemistry that accompanies them. Many scientists will say that it has been done. They've taken people in visionary state and put them into MRI scanners. And certain bits of the brain light up in the MRI scanner at that point. And the scientist says, okay, you reported a vision. I saw a bit of your brain light up. That means the vision was caused by that bit of your brain lighting up. This is the logic that's used. That's all it is. It's just brain activity. But come on. Every experience we have causes our brain to light up. The brain is what we use to experience the world. So you can't say that detecting brain activity means that the experience is not real, just because the scientist isn't seeing it. The analogy that I like to use is the analogy of the telescope. If we wish to look at a very distant star, we're going to take our telescope and we're going to point it at the star. And what we have to do is we have to adjust the focus of the telescope. And when we do that, physical changes take place in the relationship between the lenses inside the barrel of the telescope. And eventually, the star comes into view and we see it. We would be quite wrong, would we not, to say that the star is the physical changes inside the barrel of the telescope. Of course it's not. Those physical changes have simply allowed us to see that star. And that's what the suggestion is with altered states of consciousness, that they retune the receiver wavelength of the brain and allow us to see the wider reality that is there. And in that wider reality, lo and behold, we encounter the visitors. And I think we've been encountering the visitors since we first became human. And I think those encounters are what made us human. And I think that cutting ourselves off from those encounters is a fatal error of our civilization today. And it is leading us to the very edge of the abyss, this totally focused, single-minded reliance on the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness, when that state of consciousness should be recognized as only one part of a much broader spectrum. This is what is leading us straight to hell, and we need to do something about it very, very soon. And perhaps these visitor encounters are meant to help us do that. Perhaps they're meant to shake us out of this rigid frame of mind that we've got into, just like our ancestors, for a million years, kept on churning out the same kind of tools. We're doing it now. The tools are better, but we've got the same idea. A technological fix is going to be the answer to everything. We never address the spiritual side of issues. I believe that if we do not solve the spiritual problems, we will never solve the problems of the material world. So in conclusion, I think it might be fruitful to add targeted investigations of alien contacts through induced altered states of consciousness. This can be done. It can be done repeatedly. It can be done with multiple volunteers. And we can get some interesting results. And secondly, I think that the entire UFO community would benefit from more coordination with shamans in surviving hunter-gatherer societies all around the world. So that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. If I'm ahead of schedule, I don't know if I am, but if I am, I'll be very happy to take questions. Would anybody like to ask me a question? Yes. Are we androids? Well, one thing's for sure. What we could definitely be living in now is virtual reality. There's no doubt. I mean, the objective of virtual reality is to create a completely seamless experience where you don't know that it's virtual. Maybe that's what we're all having. You know, maybe we entered some kind of computer game and we're going to come out of it and see who won after 80 years or whatever. I'm not sure what the answer to your question is. I think you know, the greatest mystery in the universe is life, being alive and what it is exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. I do address this in the book more than I've done here, and thank you for that helpful question. Jung, in his book on flying saucers, was really foxed by that particular problem, because he wanted to say that flying saucers are largely a psychic phenomenon, but then he observed that some of them actually show up on radar screens. And so he said, we seem to have something here that is a materialized psychism. And he said that this materialized psychism opens a bottomless abyss at my feet, so I will not continue to explore it. And I guess I'm saying much the same thing. I think, I'll come to you in a second. I think that if I were to put a theory on it, I think that the visitor phenomenon is an interdimensional phenomenon. That's where I would put my money on. I'm not sure at any rate that it is entirely about beings, you know, a bit like us, from other planets in this physical universe, maybe many light years away, but they're all part of the same physical level of reality that we are. I think the elusive nature of the phenomenon, the way it shows up sometimes and doesn't show up sometimes, the way it's very hard to pin down, is more consistent with some kind of interdimensional jump, and maybe that's what the vehicles are. They're a way of jumping dimensions and going back. You know, maybe we have interdimensional explorers who are coming to the Earth. My instinct is that it's to do with that there is a physical component to it, there are physical traces, but they're much more elusive than they would be if it were a wholly physical and material phenomenon. Yeah.
Yeah, I would issue a caveat emptor. Yeah, you've spoken very eloquently about ayahuasca, but there's ayahuasca and ayahuasca. And as you know, there are many types of ayahuasca, and I'm not, mostly for people who might want to go out and try this. What we've seen in the U.S. is, because there is an underground that does this, generally greatly diluted, the effects are usually not anywhere near similar to what you experience. But with the curanderos that we worked with, like I say, the experiences are quite varied. And also, and as you showed when they were making it, they do the Icaros, which there is a spiritual component to this, as well as psychopharmaceutical. And as we discussed last night, I'm convinced it's not purely psychopharmaceutical.
The setting in which the brew is taken is crucially important. Again, I'll come back to the analogy of focusing a telescope. The process of focusing a complex instrument like the human brain doesn't just involve psychopharmacology. It also involves the setting in which you do that. And your intent, having a clear intent, that's a very important part of the refocusing exercise. To answer your broader question, you may or may not be aware that the Supreme Court in the United States has now voted twice in favor of allowing religious groups to use ayahuasca. The federal police cannot stop them doing so. And this is the União de Vegetal, which is one of the Brazilian syncretic groups, and also the Santo Daime, who are present in the United States as well. There is a problem with freelance individuals with no experience of ayahuasca posing as or purporting to be Western shamans who offer ayahuasca to increasingly large groups of people. I'm afraid that at some stage in the next few years, we're going to see a death as a result of this. Ayahuasca is a very serious business. It is something to be not entered into lightly. Rather like a dangerous sport, I would say, rather like jumping out of a plane or doing deep scuba diving. You want to say to yourself that what I am doing is not entirely risk-free and that I must take this on board when I do it. In the Amazon, they have thousands of years of experience of working with ayahuasca, and their shamans do, by and large, know what to do when a person has a troubling journey. I'm afraid that that's not the case in the West, and there may be problems and difficulties there. Nevertheless, I have a lot of trust in the vine, and I do believe that a loving entity who cares for the human race lies behind it. No great adventure or exploration can be taken completely risk-free. And that is also one of the problems of our society today, is that we're very unwilling to take even intellectual risks. So I think we're entering a new area here. I think Western culture is going to have to adjust and adapt to it. Western culture will not succeed in crushing it and suppressing it. It must adapt to it, and the signs are in the United States that is already happening. So I'm optimistic for the future, but it's going to be a rocky road.
Yeah, I would just say if you're going to go down, check out the shamans first.
Definitely check out the shamans
first.
Do
some checking because there are
like any field, there are charlatans operating. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, here I am. I'm sorry about that. I'm totally discriminating here. Yes. Go ahead. Oh, you're going to get the microphone.
According to Mike Salva, one third of the ETs are good, are bad, and two thirds are good. And this might be with the shamans also, because I had an unbelievable experience about 6 months ago. I was at a lecture, there was only about six people there, and she's very experienced, this girl, and she was dowsing over a shaman, just his name, mm-hmm. and I felt a big ball of energy jump into my body, and I actually screamed, mm-hmm. and I thought I just picked up energies. And when I got home, I realized I picked up a lot of entities, and I have an energy machine that gets rid of entities. So, but this, it took me a whole month, and probably there's still 10% left. Mm-hmm. So I think it could also be very dangerous dealing with shamans.
Yes.
Plus, there are demonic forces, and according to Coast to Coast, if you get demonic forces, you feel burning in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never felt burning into my body, except after this thing with the shaman.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. You're making a very important point, and I will elaborate on that just a little bit. Yes, the spirit world is not all good. Seems that the whole of reality is pervaded by this duality between good and evil. And I believe that that pervades spirit realms as well as physical realms. When you venture into those realms, you must armor yourself against that. You must be very clear in your intent and in what you are doing. It is not risk-free to step into the spirit world. But it's not risk-free to step into this physical world either. And this physical world is full of evil and wickedness, which beams itself to us all the time. So I think that actually we're more in danger at a spiritual level from our experiences in this realm than we are in the spirit world, but nevertheless, it's important to take care. Yes.
Visions that were ensued with these drugs for 2012, the spiritual aspect of it. And the other thing, I was curious about your father. You said that you had visions of your father, and I was curious about your experience, if you'd like to share that.
Yeah. With the Ibogaine, I sensed my father's presence on the very outskirts of a crowd of ghosts that appeared to be surrounding me. It was an elusive presence, and I felt that. You see, I felt very bad after my father died because I wasn't with him on his deathbed. He lived a long way from me, 500 miles, and he was dying of cancer. We were going up and seeing him every week and spending a few days, and then I had to go back home and work, and he seemed fine, and I went back home, and then he died. And I wasn't there. I felt very bad about it. I did get some closure on this with the Ibogaine experience and with ayahuasca, but I don't think I'm quite there yet. I think I need to do more, and maybe this gap of communication between myself and my father is you know rooted in very many years going back, and it still continues now that he's in the spirit world. No, I saw him, but he didn't speak to me. Who he has spoken to again and again and again is my wonderful wife, Santha. He speaks to Santha, but he won't speak to me. I keep on hoping. Vision from 2012. I think the most important thing, and this may not be directly answering your question, but I'm just going to say this anyway, the most important thing that all of us can do is to manifest and express and will and focus our intent on a good outcome to 2012. And for God's sake, let's stop dwelling on this destruction and chaos and the collapse of the world and the global tidal wave. And I don't want to hear any more about that. We are manifesting that. Let's manifest a good future world. Let's not manifest the destruction of this beautiful planet.
All right. Boy, am I right.